Special Committee on Budget, Public Safety Subcommittee for Thursday, July 14, 2005. We are in work session on Senate Bill 301 relating to use of physical force. And Mr. Wilson, if you would walk through the staff summary, and Mr. Shepherd, if you would come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I will first of all state that I am definitely not an expert on this bill, and if Mr. Shepherd can jump in at any time, it would be greatly appreciated on my part. Briefly, Senate Bill 301 deals with the use of deadly physical force and planning things before around that. Briefly, each county is required to set up a process and a committee, which are chaired by the DA and the sheriff of the county, to draft plans relating to education, training, in terms of police officers using deadly physical force, provide that plans need to address officer support after such incident, the investigative process after such incident, in the terms of how the district attorney uses discretion after each incident, where there may be a criminal responsibility, and certain data collections and debriefing after an incident takes place, the requirements for that. These plans must be approved by a certain share of the local governments in each county, and then they must be approved and or reviewed and approved by the Attorney General. The cost of implementing these plans, if there are sufficient funds, or they're subject to the level of appropriated funds, the Department of Justice may make grants to local jurisdictions in terms of reimbursing for up to 75% of their costs of implementing the plan. The bill also lays out certain requirements of local governments and officers involved in incidents, and in terms of providing specific information requirements that must be collected and periodically published following the use of deadly force. And then it also requires that the grand jury, certain portions of the grand jury proceedings on these types of cases be recorded by a certified, not court reporter, can't think what we're calling them now, shorthand reporter is what the bill said, and then sets out timelines and release requirements for these transcripts. Again, the Department of Justice, subject to the availability of funds, are to pay for the cost of the reporter and the making those transcripts available to the public and others that are set out in the bill. There is one amendment to this bill on page 11, and that is to insert $300,000 general fund. That is the only amendment that I am aware of now. Here are some materials that Mr. Shepherd from the Department of Justice brought to the committee also.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. And Mr. Shepherd, my request, good afternoon. My request for you is that you lead us through a careful walkthrough of what is provided for in the measure. I want to ensure that we are laying down a good record this afternoon of why the bill is before us, what is required through this measure, and then also establish what a future legislature or the next legislature may need to consider with regard to continued implementation of the policy pieces.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. Mr. Wilson has distributed two pieces of material to you that I hope will be helpful in fulfilling the chair's request of me. And to that end, let me organize a few comments in this way. First, give you a little bit of the history first of all, the nature of the issue that we're addressing, then how we've addressed it, with how the Attorney General has helped address it with Senator Gordley's assistance and the assistance of many others, then turn to an overview of the particular proposal, and then get a, address a couple of specifics and stand by for questions from the committee.
Very good.
Let me first say that we recognize that police officers are charged with serving and protecting their fellow Oregonians. And part of that service is fulfilled in some instances as authorized by state law under the exercise of the extraordinary power to take lives if necessary in order to carry out their responsibilities as police officers. That's a very special kind of authority, and the fact that every one of those instances involves very profound consequences for everyone involved in that incident merits very careful examination by the state and, we think, by in the form addressed by this bill. We estimate that in the course of a year's time, there are approximately 24 such incidents across the state. And so, in our view, this is, for that reason, not merely an issue for a single part of the state, and also for the reason that the fundamental statutory framework within which officers are empowered to use this tool in service to their communities is a state statute. And for those reasons, we think this is a genuine issue for state concern, but it is one that must be addressed in a comprehensive way that recognizes the important role that the local communities play in addressing this question. And so, turning now to the history of how we've approached this. Last session, as perhaps you may recall, there was an effort near the end of the Legislative Assembly to address these issues, and that effort did not succeed in, didn't result in a change in public policy that session. But as a result in part of that, the Attorney General organized an interim work group, which we came to identify as a task force, which consisted of a huge array of, very numerous array of every imaginable viewpoint that might be brought to bear on this question. It included law enforcement officials at every part of the state. It included family members of individuals whose lives had been taken by police officers in the course of the police officer's duty. It included psychological professionals, people who are expert in the treatment of the trauma that ensues in the aftermath of these incidents, both for, interestingly, the families of the individuals whose lives are taken in these incidents, but also for the police officers and the members of their families who also are traumatized by these experiences. We had engaged in that process civil attorneys who work for county governments and city governments to whom it ultimately falls the responsibility of defending civil lawsuits, which are perhaps the most certain outcome of these incidents. In almost every incident, there is some form of civil lawsuit that ensues from the incident, and so it was important to recognize that a comprehensive approach to this problem is necessarily going to have to take into account the fiscal implications for the local jurisdictions and how we relate the defense of the civil cases that arise from these matters to the other elements of the problem. And so those folks participated as well and helped shape the policy. That group met a number of times as a large group, and then there were subcommittees that worked on specific aspects of the problems, and I'm pleased to say that one of those subcommittees dealt specifically with the question of how these policy choices might influence or be influenced by collective bargaining agreements to which individual police officers might be members as a result of their association. And so we had the active participation in these in our group, and I think very constructive participation of representatives of labor unions who represent associations of police officers, including, among others, Robert King from the association representing Portland police officers. One of the things that the Attorney General did during the course of developing Senate Bill 301 is invite various folks to come to specific out-of-office hours meetings with the Attorney General, which we characterized as listening groups. Typically, these were organized around particular themes. So, for example, we did two meetings that were organized around the theme of having officers share directly with the Attorney General their individual personal experience in incidents in which their duties called upon them and required them to use deadly force. And so on two evenings, once in Eugene and once in Portland, the Attorney General sat down with, in one instance, I think there were about almost 20 officers, and in the Eugene meeting there were fewer than that, all of whom had themselves been placed in circumstances in which they were required to use deadly force in the course of their duties. Those were very powerful meetings, as one might expect, and very informative, and I think the final form of the bill, as I describe some of the details, you'll see that the input from those officers carried through to the final form of the bill. We also, similarly, had listening group meetings with communities that had themselves experienced the form of trauma that follows on some of these incidents. And so, for example, the Albina Ministerial Alliance hosted an evening session in which the Attorney General met with various representatives who were drawn together by that group. And included in that group, again, were individuals whose family lives had been directly affected by these incidents. And so, again, I hope that in the final form of the bill you'll be able to see tracing through some of the influences and the lessons that we learned from those folks. Let me give you then just a little bit of an overview of the basic structure of the bill, because I think you can see that it reflects the learning that we experienced in those meetings. And I should say that the bill as it arrives to you comes to you from the Judiciary Committee, which conducted a thorough hearing. Then, at the request of the committee, we had a smaller work group in which the form of the bill as originally introduced was further refined, and it then was further amended by the Judiciary Committee before it arrived here, and arrives here with bipartisan support from the Judiciary Committee with a do pass recommendation, and I should say in addition with the full endorsement of the Attorney General, and among others in the law enforcement community, the Clackamas County District Attorney, the Multnomah County District Attorney, and Marion County Sheriff Raul Ramirez. To the bill, then, in terms of the overview of the bill, probably I'll just give you a little bit of a 10,000-foot level, and then I'll turn to one of the exhibits to give you some more detail on that overview. In basic structure, the core of the bill, or one important element of the bill, is a state requirement that local jurisdictions consciously plan for every aspect, both the pre-incident aspects and the post-incident aspects, the investigations and the evaluation of the officer's conduct. A very important thing to recognize about this bill is it is an effort to articulate a constructive partnership between the state requiring the effort at the local jurist level, but leaving the flexibility in the local authorities and under the local jurisdictions authorities to tailor plans that make sense for the local community's concerns. We heard in the course of developing the bill very clearly that the plan for dealing with these incidents or for training officers or for handling the aftermath or for evaluating the conduct of the officers involved that works in one part of the state may not be the best suited for another part of the state. And so what we have tried to capture here is a very flexible system in which a local planning authority is created by state law to be headed by the district attorney and the local sheriff, the two elected criminal justice officials in each of our counties. Those two individuals are responsible for chairing the planning authority, which will develop the plan. But almost every element of what the local jurisdictions must include in those plans is left up to the local jurisdictions. Those are to be local choices. A bookend part of that partnership is what brings us to the Senate Budget Committee today, and that is that in order to make it possible for the local jurisdictions to carry out these plans and to make these plans be more than simply a hope, is some level of state partnership to help fund aspects of the plans. So, for example, the local jurisdiction, one required element of the plan is that it address how the local jurisdiction is to treat and to deal with police officers in the aftermath of an incident. And I'll talk a little more about the details in a second, but one important thing that we came to realize as a result of our inquiries about this bill is that a police officer who is involved in one of these incidents is not in a mental state that he or she ought to be returned to duty immediately. He can't give his best service to the community in those conditions, and so we thought it appropriate to say in the plans, you've got to have a plan that addresses the aftermath. Part of the plan has to say how you're going to treat officers, and one required element of the plan is that the officers are not allowed to return to active duty, to another situation in which they may be confronted with the decision about whether to use deadly physical force for a period of 72 hours after the incident. Now, that's going to impose a local cost. Local jurisdictions conceivably, particularly in the smaller agencies, will incur costs as a result of not being able to have that officer take his or her assigned patrol shift in the regular rotation. And so, for example, the jurisdiction might incur overtime costs to bring in someone else or to bring in someone from a neighboring jurisdiction to help fulfill that requirement. And so the state, the funds that we hope you will appropriate today and that the Assembly will ultimately approve, will provide the financial resources to assist agencies that face those kinds of costs. So conceptually, state mandate that there be local planning processes in each of the counties, local planning process fundamentally responsible for all of the content of their plans with a few exceptions, state partnership to provide grants that would be administered by the Department of Justice to reimburse local jurisdictions for those, for some of those costs. There are a couple of other pieces in broad picture that I want to give you before I go through a few more details. This bill does a couple of things with respect to the ultimate treatment of the evaluation of the officer's conduct. Under current law, and for the next 2 years under the bill, it is possible for a district attorney to convene an inquest jury to examine whether officers have engaged, to examine the conduct of the officers who were engaged in the incident. We learned in talking with officers and citizen members and district attorneys that the current inquest process is a very inadequate tool for giving the community a transparent window on all of the circumstances in which deadly force was used. The inquest process wreaks considerable further injury to the officers who feel as though they're on trial in a public forum, and it reminds them of the trauma of the incident in which, in many cases, they simply view themselves as having done a part of their duty that they would very much rather not have had to do, but nonetheless were compelled to do by the circumstances. And so what we provided in the bill is that inquests will be eliminated for the purpose of examining police officer conduct that results in a death, effective 2 years from the effective date of the bill. It'd be our frank projection that it's unlikely that any district attorney will convene any grand jury, any inquests in the interim anyway, but we think it's appropriate for the state to say that that's not an appropriate tool, effective 2 years from the effective date. However, it's also very important to provide the community with a way to learn everything there is to learn about the circumstances of these incidents. And so we also have provided that the district attorney may bring one of these matters to a grand jury. And if the district attorney brings a matter to the grand jury, then the change that we're working in law with respect to the grand jury proceeding is that that is required to be recorded, transcribed word for word, and further that transcription is available under most circumstances to the community once the grand jury has concluded its deliberations about the case. And so it would be in a jurisdiction that elected to send these matters to grand jury. And I want to emphasize that again, that the choice as to whether to send them to grand jury or not is to be, as it is under current law, a locally determined evaluation that would be part of the planning process. But in jurisdictions that elected to send these matters to grand jury, then the one window on these events would be through the grand jury transcript. That's an important overall piece of this bill.
In fact, grand jury recordings are not currently required, is a part of the point that you're making.
Indeed, Senator. Madam Chair, the current law permits but does not require a district attorney to cause a recording to be made of grand jury proceedings. Let me turn to a few of the details. The explicit planning process, and I'll contrast them with the current law. There is, under current law, no explicit requirement that jurisdictions plan for these incidents. Now, many jurisdictions, to their great credit, have consciously thought through these incidents, but I would tell you that we learned of no jurisdiction that had addressed these incidents in terms of a comprehensive examination that looked consciously at all elements of the matter. I've touched briefly on the financial incentives. There is currently no state support for local jurisdictions that have created some system for dealing with these matters. For example, under current law, if a district attorney elects to record a grand jury proceeding, the costs of making that transcription are borne locally and not by the state of Oregon. The bill will change that so that the costs of transcribing grand jury proceedings are borne entirely by the state of Oregon in these cases that are submitted to grand jury. There is, under current law, no requirement that officers who are involved in one of these incidents receive any form of psychological counseling or help so that they may be returned as soon as possible to full effectiveness in their duties and service to their communities. And so the bill contains a requirement that local jurisdictions, as part of their plan, provide at least 2 visits to a psychological counselor within the 6 months following the incident, and provide state support for the costs of doing those, of providing those services. Again, I would tell you that we learned in the Attorney General's task force effort that there are in fact jurisdictions that provide those services to their officers, but there also are jurisdictions that do not. And so we think that's a sensible thing for the state to require and then to step up and help pay for. Current law contains no explicit prohibition against having a law enforcement agency be solely responsible for the investigation of its own officers. One of the things that we learned from community members is that they need to be certain as they can be, that the investigation of these matters and the conclusions that are reached about them are reached, conducted and reached by persons who are not themselves intimately and bound up in the same organization that is responsible for the investigation or the evaluation. And although I would say it's almost universally the case that in Oregon law enforcement agencies will bring in outside agencies to assist, that's almost universally the practice. Nonetheless, the bill ensures that that will continue to be the practice by forbidding any agency from being solely responsible for the investigation of its own officers. We learned from the civil lawyers who participated in the work group process that when an evaluation, when officers and more particularly jurisdictions, and particular police agencies set about in the aftermath of one of these incidents to examine the lessons learned from the incident, that the civil attorneys will advise their charges that as your lawyer, it's my recommendation that you don't write down your conclusions. Because if you write down your conclusions, they will emerge as an exhibit used against the jurisdiction in the subsequent civil litigation that almost inevitably is going to ensue. And so Section 6 of the bill provides that when a jurisdiction does an examination of lessons learned from the incident and reaches conclusions and recommendations about how to incorporate those lessons going forward, that those written conclusions and recommendations will not be admissible in the subsequent civil proceeding. And we hope that will encourage jurisdictions to engage in an after-action examination of their own conduct that will be as self-critical as necessary in order to create real change going forward to the extent that that is required. I've talked about the grand jury proceeding and the inquest, and I just want to mention a detail that's very clear from the text of the bill and from its intent, and that is that nothing in the bill requires any district attorney to change his or her current practice with respect to the evaluation and assessment of these incidents. Nothing in the bill requires any such change. What the bill does require is the jurisdiction to explicitly plan for how they're going to deal with this. So, for example, a jurisdiction that currently has the practice of having the district attorney alone and independently make his or her own judgment based on the police reports could continue that practice if that is what the local jurisdiction elects to do in their plan. Madam Chair, I think that the remaining details really are details about the administration of the grant plan, kinds of things that are eligible for funding and reimbursement. I want to leave you with just one detail that it's easier to show you on a chart than it is to explain in the language of the bill, but I'm very confident it's provided expressly in the bill. And that is the way the grant program is operated, the funds that we hope you'll appropriate for that grant fund are not to be dispersed until July 1, 2006, a year from now. And the reason for that is that between now and July 1 of 2006, this is the period during which the local jurisdictions are responsible for developing their plans. When those plans are developed, then grants will be available for the purposes specified in the bill. But until then, we won't be sending out any money to the local jurisdiction. But we recognize that the planning process itself will impose costs on the local jurisdictions. There isn't any question about that. And so what we envision is a process in which the local jurisdictions keep track of the costs that they incur in the planning process. In effect, we will bank those costs as credits. When the grants begin to be issued in July of 2006, they would be issued as a 75% state grant and 25% local match. But local jurisdictions that have banked credits can spend those credits before they're required to spend any cash. So the second sheet that I've given you, it's titled Two Simple Illustrations of Financial Incentives and Funding Under the Bill. One of them is the chief of the hypothetical Oregon Police Department, and the chief spends 100 hours in planning costs, and we imagine that that might be accounted for as $10,000 in costs. That gets banked as a credit to the benefit of the city of hypothetical. The second example, the contrasting example, is the chief of Second City Police Department, and she spends no time in the planning process, and so Second City accumulates no credits in the planning process. When July 1, 2006 rolls around, and an incident happens in each of those jurisdictions which would be eligible for a grant, the city of hypothetical will have those banked 10,000 hours to spend as their matching credit. And so in my example, the expenditure is $300 for the counseling that I've described for the two officers. In the case of the hypothetical police department, the state would pay all $300. In the case of the Second City Police Department, because it had no credits to apply to its matching portion, it's going to be responsible for 25% of the total, and the state would only pay $225 in that case. And conceptually and in detail, that's how the grant program would work. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've really taken up a lot of your time and a lot of detail and kind of jumped around a lot, but I think it's important to understand we've tried to create a partnership here that addresses a matter of statewide concern in a way that allows local jurisdictions a tremendous amount of flexibility to insert the content of their local plans. And we think this is a very important step forward, and we urge your favorable action on the appropriation today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shepherd. Discussion? Questions? Comments?
I have a question of Mr. Wilson, because I think it needs to be on the record, because as we talk about this issue of physical force, and also we have talked in the past about training, just to assure that when we have passed other budgets like the DPSST budget, that there is the intent to have officer training, because this particular packet does not address that particular issue. Because if someone's outside listening to this conversation, they may not know that there's other pieces of budgets where training is discussed and it is expected. So,
Senator Winters, you make an excellent point, and Mr. Shepherd, this is an opportunity for you, if you wish, to make that direct link between the policy piece that you have outlined and what isn't expected in the enhancement. Thank you. In the enhancement that we are providing to the expect to provide to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, moving from 10 weeks to 16 weeks of training and beginning to address some. To address what have been serious deficiencies in training offered through the academy.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, two aspects. First, to the chair's observation, she's exactly correct. I know that the assembly and the chair and other members have committed to help the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training move ahead on their plans to expand the program there, and indeed. DPSST had representatives on the Attorney General's task force, and issues of training were much discussed. In our initial fiscal presentation to your staff, we had included a position that would have been dedicated to training, and that was in part included at the request of the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and also responsive to some of the findings we found in the course of our task force, because Senator Winters has correctly raised the question of training as an important element in the big picture here. And what we found was that there are many, there is a great need for improved training for officers in this arena. Many officers have not had the opportunity to go through what's described as scenario-based training, and there are others who are much more expert in the training field than I, but as I understand it, there are systems that are available that indeed will be more available with the expanded services that the Assembly has funded at DPSST that will present officers with in effect simulations of the very critical kind of decision making that they are going to face and do face as officers in the street, and that's an opportunity to greatly improve the training we have for officers. It's not quite correct, though, to say that the bill does not address the training question, and I want to make sure that everybody's clear about that. One of the required elements of the local plan is an element dealing with education, outreach, and training regarding the use of deadly physical force for police officers, attorneys employed by state or local government within the county, and members of the community. And what we hope and expect local jurisdictions to do as they go through their planning process is to look at their own training programs and ask the question, what more can we be doing or should we be doing to address the training needs of our officers? And if indeed they include in their plan elements that require additional costs, for example, let's suppose a jurisdiction east of the Cascades decides that the critical thing for them is to be able to send an officer over to DPSST here in Salem to go through the new training range that DPSST will have on its facilities. If that's included as an element of the plan, then the costs of sending the officer over the mountains and staying in a motel room here in Salem would be reimbursable as a grant from the fund. And so this system is not designed to be, this is designed to dovetail with the training and the enhanced training that you provided at DPSST.
And the language that you're referring to around the planning and training, education outreach, is found on page 2 of the bill, starting on line 19 through about 24, 25.
Correct.
Is inclusive of what you're addressing. I guess the other thing that's important to say on the record, as it relates to the Department of Public Safety standards and training, some of the training content that they will be moving toward includes use of deadly force and the scenario-based training that you're talking about. Cultural awareness, enhanced offerings around that content, dealing with the mentally ill, gang awareness, dealing with acts of terrorism. Again, we're talking about the enhancement or addition of training content that hasn't been there in the past. I mean, this is a huge undertaking on the part of the department, long overdue. But there's an alignment here between the policy that you're laying out and with what the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is moving toward.
I'm sure that's correct.
Did you wish to continue?
No, I just believe that we needed to make that connection,
yes,
for the record, because often, you know, we're here and we have heard some of the testimony, and we also know what's been passed in other budgets, but I think sometimes we forget that these proceedings are being videoed and that others may not be aware or know of the other content that's going on. And I think of an issue that is so important and so critical to the citizens that are there, and they, you know, they read in the newspaper of what's occurring. They know that there have been incidences around the state, and so for them to even to have a comfort level to know that not only are we talking about planning and the work that was done in the Attorney General's office and with the DAs and others, but also that there is the provision in the package to address the training as well. I just wanted to make those connections because I'm aware that sometimes you have individuals that just surf channels and get bits and pieces of information out of this building. So,
Mr. Shepherd, going back to the subject of the public inquest, and again, understanding that what the bill provides for is that the public inquest would continue until July 1, 2007. Within that is the assumption that these planning processes are going to take root around the state and be underway and good things will go forward. With that said, can you talk to us about what was the discussion amongst the task force members about the trade-off? Is it accurate to call it that, or what was the tone and tenor of that discussion? Because there is the public interest in transparency. When these tragic things occur, folks want to know what happened and why did it happen, and there's that public need to know. But I'm also hearing what you're saying about the balancing of not having a star chamber, so to speak. So please, if you would, address that.
Madam Chair, the Attorney General issued a lengthy written report, which I haven't burdened this committee with, but we did distribute to the Judiciary Committee. Issued the report based on the findings of that he reached based on the task force discussions. In that report, we indicated that we weren't at that stage yet to the. We were trying to do as much as we could to leave in place all of the discretion that district attorneys have to deal with these incidents in a whole variety of ways. So we made a conscious decision not to recommend in the report itself that the inquest option be eliminated, but we did recommend that the assembly take up discussion of whether to eliminate the inquest option at some later date. Then we went to the Judiciary Committee, and the work group was formed, as I indicated, after the first hearing in the Judiciary Committee. And there we heard more about the inquest option, and we learned that really there were no district attorneys that we talked to, and none that and we talked to communicated with all of them at one stage or another that really wanted to preserve the inquest option because they all saw it as inadequate to achieve the purpose that the community needs, which is to provide transparency in a comprehensive way of all the relevant data about the given incident. And so the compromise, or trade-off, if you will, was that we thought rather than recommend to the assembly that it simply eliminate right out the front end the inquest option, we should continue to leave that as an option for the local jurisdictions until July 1, 2007. And that would permit the local jurisdictions, as they work through their planning process, to make a conscious decision about how they wanted to approach these incidents. And as it turns out, that the ultimate elimination of the inquest was something that was very important to the law enforcement officers involved. And so the judgment we made was that we could satisfy the interest of law enforcement officers who felt like the inquest was a star chamber, just as you have suggested, and still provide the community transparency through the alternative of the grand jury proceeding with the transcribed proceedings. And so that's the balance we struck in that. And we think it's a balance that will stand the test of time.
I do have a question as to whether or not during those hearings that any members from the community, I do not, and when I say the community, like that actually provided some input on that particular issue. And I want to go back to what was raised by the good chair, the whole transparency of this particular issue. It's where the community feels that they are really having a vehicle to be able to get information to and from.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we did have, in the course of the task force meeting, we did have explicit discussions with the entire task force, which included community members from all walks of life and numerous parts of the state, not just law enforcement officials. And indeed, in the listening sessions, including the one that I described to you with the Albina Ministerial Alliance, for example, questions of how best to present to the community the transparent window into the decision making were explicitly addressed. What I heard in those hearings, in those proceedings, weren't as formal as hearings, but in those proceedings was a near universal desire for the community to have an accessible record and one that is comprehensive. We did not hear a preference for the inquest forum as opposed to a transcribed grand jury proceeding.
Was that question posed as a choice?
Madam Chair, I don't know that. I don't think we said, which of these would you prefer. Mm-hmm. We said we have these alternatives under current law. We have grand jury proceedings, which under current law typically are not transcribed when they occur. And we have inquest juries, which are rarely convened, but have been convened in some communities. And the issue quickly in our task force meetings and in the listening groups, it quickly moved from we have these two options to we need to have transparency. How we get there was not an explicit issue in those meetings.
When I step back in time and just kind of recall how this bill got started and fast forward to where we are today, the Albina Ministerial Alliance and their ad hoc committee played a very pivotal role in not just requesting but demanding that there be public policy attention paid to this broad subject. And knowing that they were at the table, active participants in the task force, and knowing that the product we have here is, is it accurate to call it a consensus document?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would not say, and we have not claimed, that every member of the task force supports the product. I'm not aware of any association that opposes, from any of the various interest groups that opposes the product. I will tell you there are individual law enforcement officials who do not support it, just as there are individual law enforcement officials who do support it. I would suspect that amongst the membership of different organizations, likewise, there are folks who think that perhaps it doesn't go far enough in the direction that they would like it to go. And so I wouldn't claim consensus in that sense. I would tell you that I think we have tried to address every concern that we heard in a principled way in this bill.
Again, just trying to seek as much clarity as possible for our record. again, getting to the Albina Ministerial Alliance and their participation. With regard to the public inquest piece, are you comfortable in saying where they are with that particular piece of the broad policy that's being presented here?
Madam Chair, I wouldn't presume to speak for them.
And I understand that.
Yeah.
I'm really seeking information about whether there was a specific conversation or in the course of the task force meetings something explicit was said on your record that this was an okay piece or folks were had concerns or were comfortable moving forward, just something.
Madam Chair, what I can tell you beyond what I've already said about the deliberations of the task force is that this has been a very open process, and during the working group meetings that followed the first hearing in the Judiciary Committee, we circulated the developing drafts, which included this element,
okay,
to everybody under the sun. And we got lots of comments back from people, and we didn't hear from anybody that they objected to the eventual elimination of the inquest. Now, I don't want to claim too much from that silence, but I will tell you that everybody knew that that was part of the bill.
I do want to say here that the process that that took place, that's still ongoing, has been a remarkable one. It has been very thorough. But it's also the quality of leadership that you've provided and that the Attorney General has provided, Ronell Schenkel, others in your department, Kevin Neely, you know all the names, you know them better than I, has really been remarkable. And I do want to affirm that a quality of leadership has been provided here that makes this discussion possible. I want to affirm that and also honor that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've appreciated your leadership on this, too. I think we've moved along a long ways because of your involvement.
Senator Devlin, did you have questions or comments? You're unusually quiet this afternoon.
No, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, since he's unusually quiet, I probably should take this opportunity if you're ready for a motion, and I will precede my comments with my motion of also concurring in second that there, I don't think that there's anyone on this side of the policy discussion that has been more focused on this particular issue than Senator Gordley, and who has pushed and continued to keep it in the forefront of everyone's minds and thoughts. And I do want to acknowledge, you know, her leadership. And with that, Madam Chair, I move, I know that Mr. Wilson will correct me if I'm incorrect, that we amend the amendment to Senate Bill 301. It's a conceptual amendment, is that correct? Conceptual amendment, as stated above in it's about three paragraphs.
Actually, it's only the above. It should be
the above. And on page 11, line 1, insert
yes.
300,000.
Senator Winters has moved that Senate Bill 301 be amended with the conceptual amendment found on page 11, line 1, inserting $300,000. Is there discussion? Objection? Adopted. Senator Winters?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 301 as amended to the full Senate Special Budget Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Winters has moved Senate Bill 301 as amended to the full Senate Special Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Adopted. Anything else for the record? Mr. Wilson, I'll carry the bill to the Budget Committee at 2:04. Anything else for the government? Okay. Thank you, and we are adjourned. Thank you.